Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Well, this evening I'm going to do a little something different. Instead of having a guest or even just open lines, I'm going to read you congressional testimony. This was given on the 18th of September by Kristen Breitweiser, who is the co-chairperson for the September 11th Advocates, a group of the families of the people who died in the World Trade Center. And Kristen testified before the Joint Senate Congressional Intelligence Committee, and I thought her testimony was so important, and of course it was pretty well ignored by the mass media, so I thought I'd share it with you. Now, the families of the people who perished feel that they've been betrayed by the government. They were promised that the president would support an independent investigation to try to find out what really happened, why nothing was done. And, of course, the president promised, oh, we're going to have an investigation, and I'm going to back it. And then in recent weeks, he's done everything, and the administration's done everything they can to block an independent investigation. Now, the committee that's meeting now just about finished their testimony, and, of course, it will be forced to adjourn, and that'll be the end of the investigation. And, of course, all the information they're getting is coming from the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI, or the very agencies that they are investigating to find out why this happened. And there's no independent investigation. People aren't being called in from outside to testify under oath to really get the truth of what happened. And it would appear that the administration is fully intent upon blocking any effort on the part of the families of those who perished to find out what really happened. And the question is why? Well, there's a wonderful book. It's called See No Evil. It's written by a man named Robert Byrd, who spent 25 years in the CIA. And in 1995, he was the chief CIA operations officer in northern Iraq, and he headed the organization there with a number of other CIA agents underneath him. In his recent book, See No Evil, he comments that a reporter friend of his told him that recently a high-ranking, one of the highest-ranking CIA officials had said to him off the record that when the dust settles after September 11th, why the public will realize that what happened was a triumph for intelligence, not a failure. The public will realize that what happened on September 11th was a triumph for intelligence agencies, not a failure. How could the death of 3,000 Americans be a triumph? Well, let me read you this testimony and then contemplate we would not be going to war in the Middle East had it not been for September 11th. There is no way that the American people could have been talked into going into this terrible, terrible war that lies ahead of us had it not been for the tragic events. So let me proceed. And I'm simply going to be quoting from Kristen Breitweiser from here on. I'd like to thank the families of the 3,000 victims for allowing me to represent them here today. Before the Joint Intelligence Committee, it's a tremendous honor. Testifying before this committee is a privilege and an enormous responsibility that I do not take lightly. I'll do my best not to disappoint the families or the memories of their loved ones. Toward that end, I ask the members present here today to find in my voice the voices of all of the family members of the 3,000 victims of September 11th. I would also ask you to see in my eyes the eyes of more than 10,000 children who are now forced to grow up without the love, affection, and guidance of a mother or a father who was tragically killed on September 11th. I now like to thank the members of the Joint Intelligence Committee, Eleanor Hill and her staff, for giving the families this opportunity to be heard. It's been an excruciating and overwhelming 12 months, and it is now time for our words and our concerns to be heard by you. My 3-year-old daughter's most enduring memory of her father will be placing flowers on his empty grave. My most enduring memory of my husband, Ronald Reitweiser, will be his final words to me. Sweets, I'm fine. I don't want you to worry. I love you. And Ron uttered those words while he was watching men and women jump to their deaths from the top of Tower 1. And 4 minutes later, his tower was hit by United Flight 175. I never spoke to my husband, Ron, again. I don't really know what happened to him. I don't know whether he jumped or he choked to death on smoke. I don't know whether he sat curled up in a corner watching the carpet melt in front of him, knowing that his own death was soon to come, or if he was alive long enough to be crushed by the building when it collapsed. These are the images that haunt me at night when I put my head to rest on his pillow. I do know that the dream I had envisioned, that I so desperately needed to believe, that he was simply turned to ash and floated up to the heavens, was simply not his fate. I know this because his wedding band was recovered from ground zero with a part of his left arm. The wedding band is charred and scratched, but still perfectly round and fully intact. I wear it on my right hand. It will remain there until the day that I die. September 11th was the devastating result of a catalog of failures on behalf of our government and its agencies. My husband and the approximately 3,000 others like him who went to work and never came home. But were any of our government agencies doing their job on that fateful morning? Perhaps the carnage and devastation of September 11th speaks for itself in answering that question. Our intelligence agencies suffered an utter collapse in their duties and responsibilities leading up to and on September 11th. But their negligence does not stand alone. Agencies like the Port Authority, the City of New York, the FAA, the INS, the Secret Service, NORAD, and the Air Force, and the airlines also failed our nation that morning. Perhaps, said more cogently, one singular agency's failures do not eclipse another's. And it goes without saying that the examination of the intelligence agencies by this committee does not distract, discount, or dismantle the need for a more thorough examination of all of these other culpable parties. An independent blue ribbon panel would be the most appropriate means to achieve such a thorough and expansive examination, in large part because it would not be limited in scope or hindered by time limits. An independent blue ribbon panel would provide a comprehensive, unbiased, and definitive report that the devastation of September 11th demands. Soon after the attack, President Bush stated that there would come a time to look back and examine our nation's failures, but that such an understanding was inappropriate while our nation was still in shock. I would respectively suggest to President Bush and to our Congress that now, a full year later, it is time to look back and investigate our failures as a nation. A hallmark of democratic government is a willingness to admit, to analyze, and learn from mistakes. And it is now time for our nation to triumph as the great democracy that it is. The families of the victims of September 11th have waited long enough. We need to have answers. We need to have accountability. We need to feel safe living and working in this great nation. On May 17th, 2002, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice stated emphatically, "I don't think anybody could have predicted that these people would take an airplane and slam it into the World Trade Center, that they would try to use an airplane as a missile, a hijacked airplane as a missile." But the historic facts illustrate differently. In 1993, a $150,000 study was commissioned by the Pentagon to investigate the possibility of an airplane being used to bomb national landmarks. A draft document of this was circulated throughout the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the FEMA. In 1994, a disgruntled FedEx employee invaded the cockpit of a DC-10 with plans to crash the plane into the company's building in Memphis. In 1994, a lone pilot crashed a small plane into a tree on the White House grounds. In 1994, an Air France flight was hijacked by members of the armed Islamic group with the intent to crash the plane into the Eiffel Tower. In January 1995, Philippine authorities investigated Abdul Murad, an Islamic terrorist, and unearthed Project Bajenka. That was primarily a plan to blow up 11 airlines over the Pacific, and in the alternative, several planes were to be hijacked and flown into civilian targets in the United States. Among the targets mentioned were CIA headquarters, the World Trade Center, the Sears Tower, and the White House. Murad told U.S. intelligence agent officials that he would board any American commercial airline or aircraft, pretend to be an ordinary passenger. He would then hijack the aircraft, control its cockpit, and dive it into the CIA headquarters. In 1997, this plot resurfaced during the trial of Ramzi Yousef, the mastermind behind the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. And during the trial, FBI agents testified that the plan targeted not only the CIA, but other U.S. government buildings in Washington, including the Pentagon. In September 1999, a report, The Sociological and Psychology of Terrorism, was prepared for U.S. intelligence by the Federal Research Division, an arm of the Library of Congress. It stated suicide bombers belonging to Al-Qaeda Martyrdom Battalion could crash land an aircraft packed with high explosives, that would be C-4 and Simtex, into the Pentagon, the headquarters of the CIA, or the White House. This laundry list of historical indicators, in no way exhaustive, illustrates that long before September 11th, the American intelligence community had a significant amount of information about specific terrorist threats to commercial airline travel in America, including the possibility that a plane would be used as a weapon. On March 11th, 2002, Director of the CIA George Tenet stated, in broad terms last summer, that terrorists might be planning major operations in the United States, but we never had the texture, meaning enough information to stop what happened. On May 8, 2002, Director of the FBI Robert Mueller stated, there is nothing the agency could have done to anticipate or prevent the attacks. Once again, the historical facts indicate differently. Throughout the spring and early summer of 2001, intelligence agencies flooded the government with warnings of possible terrorist attacks against American targets, including commercial aircraft like Al-Qaeda and other groups. The warnings were vague but sufficiently alarming to prompt the FAA to issue 4 information circulars, or ICs, to the commercial airline industry between June 22nd and July 31st, warnings of possible terrorism. On June 22nd of 2001, the military central and European commands imposed force protection condition Delta, the highest anti-terrorist alert. On June 28th, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said it's highly likely that a significant Al-Qaeda attack in the near future, within several weeks. As of July 31st, 2001, the FAA urged U.S. airlines to maintain a high degree of alertness. One FAA circular from late July noted, according to Condoleezza Rice, that there was no specific target, no credible information of attacks to U.S. civil aviation interests, but terror groups are known to be planning and training for hijackings, and we ask you therefore to use caution. 2 counterterrorism officials described the alerts of early and mid-summer 2001 as the most urgent in decades. One thing remains clear from this history. Our intelligence agencies were acutely aware of an impending domestic risk posed by Al-Qaeda. A question that remains unclear is how many lives could have been saved had this information been made more public. Airport security officials could have gone over all the basics again of the steps needed to prevent hijackings, the policy of allowing passengers to carry razors and knives with blades up to 4 inches in length certainly could have come under scrutiny. Indeed, officials could have issued an emergency directive prohibiting such potential weapons in carry-on bags. Finally, all selectees under the computer-assisted passenger pre-screening system and their carry-on luggage and check bags could have been suspected and subjected to additional screening. Apparently, none were on September 11th, although internal FAA documents indicate that the system had selected some of the hijackers. And how many victims may have thought twice about boarding an aircraft? How many victims would have chosen to fly on private planes? How many victims may have taken notice of those Middle Eastern men while they were boarding their plane? Could these men have been stopped? Going further, how many vigilant employees would have chosen to immediately flee Tower 2 after they witnessed the burning inferno in Tower 1? If only they had known that an Al-Qaeda terrorist attack was imminent. Could the devastation of September 11th have been diminished in any degree had the government's information been made public in the summer of 2001? On July 5th, the government's top counterterrorism official, Richard Clark, stated to a group gathered at the White House, "Something really spectacular is going to happen here, and it's going to happen soon." The group included the FAA, the Coast Guard, the FBI, the Secret Service, and the INS. Clark directed every counterterrorism office to cancel vacations, defer non-vital travel, put off scheduled exercises, and place domestic rapid response teams on much shorter alert. For 6 weeks last summer, at home and abroad, the U.S. government was at its highest possible state of readiness and anxiety against an imminent terrorist attack. A senior FBI official attending the White House meeting on July 5th committed the Bureau to redouble contacts with its foreign counterparts and to speed up transcription and analysis of wiretapes obtained under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, among other steps. But when the field office in Phoenix, Arizona, reported the suspicion of a hijacked pilot plot just 5 days later, the FBI did not share the report with any other agency. And one must ask, why? That report, written by Agent Kenneth Williams, now well known as the Phoenix Memo, recommended that the FBI investigate whether Al-Qaeda operatives were training at U.S. flight schools. Williams posited that Osama bin Laden's followers might be trying to infiltrate the civil aviation system as pilots, security guards, or other personnel, and he recommended a national program to track suspicious flight school students. Agent Williams was dead on point. But in the summer of 2001, while our nation was at its highest state of alert, his memo was flatly ignored. And what result if he hadn't been ignored? What if his memo is promptly placed on the Interlink or Spironet or Nippernet? What if other agents had the same suspicions in Florida and California, Georgia, Ohio, and Nevada? Could the terrorists have been stopped? On August 15th, 2001, an alert civilian instructor at a Minnesota flight school called the FBI and said, "Do you realize that a 747 loaded with fuel can be a bomb?" The next day, Zacharias Massoui was arrested, and after investigating Zacharias Massoui's past, the FBI, with the help of French intelligence, learned he had Islamic extremist connections. They also knew that he was interested in flight patterns around New York City, that he had a strong desire to fly big jets, even though at the time he didn't have so much as a license to fly a Cessna airplane. And then what happened? Why, the FBI in Minnesota attempted to get a FISA warrant, but they were rebuffed, a crucial mistake because Zacharias Massoui's possessions contained evidence that would have exposed key elements of the September 11th plot. But why was this request denied? Again, the historical facts must be analyzed. In March 2001, an internal debate ignited at the Justice Department and the FBI over wiretap surveillance of certain terrorist groups, prompted by questions raised by Roy C. Lambert, the chief judge of the FISA court. The Justice Department opened an inquiry into a man named Michael Resnick, an FBI official who coordinated the act's applications, and Attorney General John Ashcroft and Robert Mueller, then Deputy Attorney General, ordered a full review of all foreign surveillance authorizations. Justice Department and FBI officials have since acknowledged the existence of this internal investigation and said that the inquiry forced officials to examine their monitoring of several suspected terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. And while senior FBI and Justice Department officials contend that the internal investigation did not affect their ability to monitor Al-Qaeda, other officials have acknowledged that the inquiry might have hampered electronic surveillance of terror groups. The matter remains highly classified. What is not classified is that in early September, a Minnesota FBI agent wrote an analytic memo on Zacharias Nassiouli's case, theorizing that the suspect could fly a plane into the World Trade Center. And tragically, this too was ignored. Also ignored by U.S. intelligence agencies was the enormous amount of trading activity on the Chicago Exchange Board and overseas markets. Our intelligence agencies readily used Promise software to analyze these kind of market indicators that presented themselves in the weeks prior to September 11th. Why were these aberrant trades and market swings ignored? We were at the highest state of alert. An attack by Al-Qaeda was expected to occur at any given moment. And yet, massive amounts of trade occurred on American Airlines, United Airlines, reinsurance companies, and leaseholders in the World Trade Center, and none of our watchdogs noticed. Perhaps even more disturbing is the information regarding Khalid al-Midyar, Nawif al-Hamzmi, two of the hijackers. In late August, the CIA asked the INS to put these two men on a watch list because of their ties to the bombing of the USS Cole. On August 23, 2001, the INS informed the CIA that both men had already slipped into the country. Immediately thereafter, the CIA asked the FBI to find al-Midyar and al-Hamzmi, not a seemingly hard task in the light of the fact that one of them was listed in the San Diego phone book and the other took out a bank account in his own name, and finally, an FBI informant happened to be their roommate. But again, our intelligence agencies failed. It was only after the devastation of September 11th that our intelligence agencies seemed to get back on track. On September 12th, 2001, that's the day, of course, after the attack, the New York Times reported, on Tuesday, a few hours after the attack, FBI agents descended on flight schools, neighborhoods, and restaurants in pursuit of leads. The FBI arrived at Huffman Aviation at about 2:30 a.m. Wednesday morning. They walked out with all the school's records, including photocopies of the men's passports. The New York Times also reported that students at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University said that within hours of the attacks, FBI agents were seen at their schools. How did the FBI know exactly where to go only a few hours after the attack? How did they know which neighborhoods, which flight schools, and which restaurants to investigate so soon into the case? The New York Times went on to report that federal agents questioned employees at a store in Bangor, Maine, where five Arab men believed to be hijackers tried to rent cell phones late last week. Store employees at first refused to sell the phones because the men lacked proper identification, but they gave in after the five offered $3,000 cash, store employees and an airport official said. The article goes on to state that the men then phoned Bangor Airport trying to get a flight to Boston, were told there was no flight that matched their desired departure time. The authorities said the men then phoned Portland International Jetport, where two of them apparently made reservations for a flight to Boston on Tuesday morning. How could this information be gleaned so quickly? How would the FBI know to visit a store in Bangor, Maine, only hours after the attacks? Moreover, how would they know the details of a phone conversation that occurred a week prior to the attacks? Were any of the hijackers already under surveillance? It has been widely reported that the hijackers ran practice runs on the airline routes that were chosen on September 11th. Did our intelligence agencies ever shadow these men on any of their prior practice runs? Furthermore, on September 12th, the New York Times reported that authorities said they had also identified accomplices in several cities who had helped plan and execute Tuesday's attacks. Officials said they knew who these people were and important biographical data about them. They prepared biographies of each identified member of the hijack team and began tracing their recent movements. How were complete biographies of the terrorists and their accomplices created in such short time? Did our intelligence agency already have open files on these men? Were they already investigating them? Could the attacks of September 11th have been prevented? Well, the speed by which the FBI was able to locate, assimilate, and analyze a small amount of information so soon after the attack barely one day later, perhaps answers the question for itself. But if the terrorists were under investigation, then why were they ever permitted to board those planes? Perhaps even more potently, why, if such an investigation was already underway, why was our nation so late in responding to the emergency that quickly unfolded that day? Too many questions remain. Topping the list of unanswered questions are those that involve our nation's coordinated communication in response to the attack that morning. The 24 hours that presented themselves on September 11th beg to be examined. Questions like, why did the New York, New Jersey Port Authority not evacuate the World Trade Center when they had an open phone line with Newark Traffic Center and were told that the second plane was bearing down on the South Tower? New York, New Jersey Port Authority had at least 11 minutes of notice to begin evacuation of the South Tower. An express elevator in the World Trade Center was able to travel from top to bottom in 1 minute's time. How many lives may have been saved had the Port Authority acted more decisively, or rather, acted at all? Were F-16s and stealth bombers seen and tracked on radar screens at approximately 8:05 that morning of September 11th in the vicinity of the New York metropolitan area? Washington Air Traffic Control Center knew about the first plane before it hit the World Trade Center, yet the third plane was able to fly loop-de-loops over Washington, D.C., 1 hour and 45 minutes after Washington Center first knew about the hijackings. After circling in this restricted airspace, controlled and protected by the Secret Service, who had an open phone line to the FAA, how is it possible that the plane was then able to crash into the Pentagon? Why was the Pentagon not evacuated? Why was our Air Force so late in its response? What, if anything, did our nation do in a defensive military posture that morning? 3,000 innocent Americans were killed on September 11th, leaving their families and loved ones like myself and my daughter. There are too many heartbreaking stories to recount. There are too many lost opportunities and futures to be told. But what can be said to you today is that the families continue to suffer each and every day. All we have are tears and a resolve to find the answers, because we continue to look into the eyes of our young children who ask us, why? We have an obligation as parents and as a nation to provide those innocent children with answers as to why their mother or father never will return home again. We need people to be held responsible for their failures. We need leaders with the courage to take responsibility for what went wrong. Mistakes were made and too many lives were lost. We must investigate those errors so that they will never, ever happen again. It is our responsibility as a nation to turn the dark events of September 11th into something from which we can all learn and grow, so that we as a nation can look forward to a safe future. In closing, I would like to add one thought. Undoubtedly, each of you here today, because you live and work in Washington, D.C., must have felt that you were in the bullseye on September 11th. For most of you, there was a relief at the end of that day, a relief that you and your loved ones were in safe hands. You were the lucky ones. In your continuing investigation, please do not forget those of us who did not share your good fate. And after, of course, that ends the reading of Kristen Burt Weiser's testimony, but the question would be, why would anybody in the CIA feel that what happened on September 11th was a triumph for the intelligence agencies, not a failure? At least, unless we perhaps needed an excuse to go to war. We are entering the Third World War, ladies and gentlemen, and it's about time the American people understood. And we had that investigation, which the administration is doing everything to block. And I would ask, if there's nothing to hide, why are they hiding it? If there's nothing to conceal, why are they intent upon concealing it? We'll be right back here in just 3 minutes with the rest of the show and John Leffler. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when I need to remind you all that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will decide right now that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we are able to do what we do 5 hours every day, reaching out across America on radio, on the Internet, 3 hours every day on satellite, 2 hours every day on shortwave, but it's an expensive proposition. And quite frankly, we need your help. We hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family. And for a suggested gift of at least $20 a month or as much as you can really afford, why, we'll send you the 4 best tapes of the month. We'll send you our monthly newsletter. But we hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to become part of the Radio Liberty family, because that's how we're actually able to do what we do on a regular basis. And so if you'd like, of course, to know more about the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we hope many of you will want to partner with us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. And then, of course, we hope that you'll go to our website, www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, and that you will tell others about our website. Now, you can actually hear our programs live 3 hours every day on our website. You can pull down all sorts of archive programs. You can pull down my newsletters. And, of course, you can go to the various links that we have, because we feel that they're all good links and you'll get good information there. And so we ask you to give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family. Make it a point to tell others about our program, and make it a point, of course, to get them onto our website. Now, we want to mention here that we are going to be having a rally here, a day-long seminar on the 23rd of November here in the Monterey Bay area on preparation, because I believe that very difficult times are coming. And I think people are going to have to be physically and psychologically and spiritually and financially prepared for what lies ahead. And of all of those, the spiritual is the most important, because you have to understand the very essence of the struggle we're engaged in. But if you'd like to come, if you're living in the Monterey area, if you'd like to travel to the area, Monterey Bay is one of the most beautiful spots in the world. And, of course, there's program is going to start in the morning. Doors open at 8. Program starts at 8:45. And it'll go all through the day. There'll be a lunch and a syllabus available, and it'll go till 5 in the evening. And probably some people will be there until 6 in the evening. And we're going to have Joan Parrish and Jeannie Soderman, and, of course, Bill Sardi will be talking, Brad Dacus. I'm going to be talking. But we're going to talk about preparation for what lies ahead. And I think that's so vitally important, and we hope that you'll be able to come. If you're interested in more information, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and just ask for information on the seminar that's going to be held on the 23rd of November. That's the weekend before Thanksgiving, and where we're looking forward to seeing you there then. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were going to have John Leffler on in the next hour, but he's agreed to come on here a little bit early. And, of course, we'll invite your calls out across America in reference to what we were talking about. If you heard Kristen Breitweiser's testimony, I wonder how many of you read about that in the newspapers. So this was given in Washington, D.C. on this 18th of September, and I think it was one of the most powerful things I've ever read. Was it covered in your newspaper? Or was it covered on your television station or your radio station? You see, the reason I do what I do 5 hours a day is I can bring you the information you're never going to get elsewhere, or very seldom get elsewhere. And we'll certainly give a different slant on it than you're going to hear elsewhere, because I've been studying these things for 40 years. I've traveled to Europe, and I've traveled to Africa and lived in Africa trying to understand what was going on. And I've been to the dusty files at Georgetown University and Yale University. Yes, even to the dusty files in the basement of the Council on Foreign Relations at 5080 68th Street in New York City, America's secret government, the American extension of that secret society that Cecil Rhodes created. So we have an overview you're not going to find elsewhere. And then, of course, we have access to so many very brilliant people, and people who understand what's going on. And among those brilliant people is our good friend John Leffler. Hi, John. How are you doing?
I was afraid you were going to put me in that category. Now I have to live up to it.
Well, John, for those of you who don't know, does a weekly radio program that we carry. It's called Steel on Steel. And, of course, the program is aimed at bringing you the information you're not going to get through regular channels. And as John Offley says, you know, just because you don't know what I'm talking about doesn't make me a wacko. What's that line? I love it.
Your failure to be informed doesn't make me a wacko.
All right, fine. And, of course, that's what this is all about. You see, you're not going to get the news. You're not going to get the truth off of most radio or television programs because most of the stations are either owned by people who are part of the problem or owned by people who don't even know there's a problem, and they're not going to allow you to talk about the things that we talk about. That's why we have to buy time on radio stations. And fortunately, at least at the present time, we're able to buy the time. We are a voice and growing. We're heard on almost 50 outlets. We're heard on over 50 outlets every week of one sort or another, shortwave, internet, satellite, of radio stations. And our weekend program goes to almost 40 stations. So we have a voice. And with your help, that voice will grow. And as more and more people hear the truth, they eventually come to listen it. Well, understand and accept it. If you're out there in the listening audience and would like to give us a call, you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Had you ever heard that the testimony of Kristen's before?
No, you had to go and find it. In other words, you had to take the time to search it on the internet. And then, you know, I think I just joined the conversation here. I think you're talking about the 30 pages or so of testimony that before Congress, et cetera.
Well, basically, there's a great deal of testimony. Of course, Eleanor Hill's testimony, perhaps we can give it another time. She is the person in charge of this committee, and I think that she knows what's going on, but she wants to keep her job. So she at least allowed Kristen to speak. And if you read her testimony, which is about 30 pages in length, it's really a shocking. But, of course, Kristen's testimony is only 15 pages in length. But it is just devastating if you stop and think of the questions that she asks. How could it be that the FBI, within a couple of hours, knew who all these people were? How could it be that within a couple of hours, the FBI, you know, had all the information on all of these people? How could it be that there were no planes in the air, and yet they had an hour and 45 minutes from the, from the time that the first plane was hijacked until the last plane hit the Pentagon, and there were no Air Force planes guarding our nation's capital? And they did bring in some, yes, they brought them in, not from 2 minutes away at Andrews Air Force Base or 4 or 5 minutes away at Langley. They brought them in from Cape Cod, and these planes that can fly almost 30 miles a minute. It took them, well, they arrived 12 minutes after the plane hit the Pentagon, so they must have stopped off for lunch on the way from Cape Cod, because that's, you know, it's 12 minutes late. Well, anyway, we've got so many unanswered questions out there, and I think that she just brought this out so beautifully, and she crystallized this in her short testimony. I don't know how much of you heard, John, but I thought it was very, very touching and very effective.
Well, it did, and I'm trying to turn this forward because what's going to happen with 911, much like the Kennedy assassination and things, it's good to inquire into it, but it sort of passes into the dust of history. I'm more concerned because the CIA now is saying, and I was reading some of the intelligence stuff today, Al-Qaeda, I mean, Osama bin Laden is probably dead. He didn't really look too good in some of the latest videos. You know, he looked like somebody who was suffering from some kind of deteriorating disease. But that Al-Qaeda has regrouped, which we knew was going to happen, and that they are now in the execution phase of the next round of terror attacks on the U.S. or the West, Europe, or whatever, in going, and that they're not going to be able to protect us from that. So we went through this whole charade of airport security. We've got the Patriot Act, and we're still not going to be able to protect ourselves from whatever the next round is coming in. But we knew that anyway, didn't we?
Well, we got Ed calling in here, and Ed calling in from Aptos. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Hey, listen, I had a question for you. Can we get copies of that letter?
Sure you can.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Also, I had a question for John.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hi.
Hey, John, I've always wondered, I've tried and tried to find out if anybody has access to find it out, who is to get an exact list as to who died in those Twin Towers, and if the big guns were conveniently gone that day, and then to tie it all together. I suspect that anybody that was somebody was out of that building conveniently that day. Call me a wacko, John. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Well, I'll tell you what, the John O'Neill, former...
Yeah, I was just thinking of that, right?
John O'Neill was former head of counterterrorism for the FBI. And, of course, he quit on the 1st of August of last year, 2001, because he was so infuriated because every effort was made to block his effort to investigate the terrorism in the United States. They would not allow an investigation. Congress had appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars. There was enough money to employ 1,000 new FBI agents. You know what they did? Now, the money was put out to investigate terrorism. And what do? They send them all over the world. They put them investigating Christians and, a congressman. But none of them were allowed to investigate terrorism in America, even though that's what the money was appropriated for. And the question is, why? I mean, we have FBI officials from all over the country. A man named Wright in Chicago wanted to investigate the Islamic terrorist. He wasn't allowed to. The people in New York weren't allowed to investigate Islamic terrorism. The people in Minnesota, they couldn't get a warrant to get into Zacharias Massui's computer, laptop computer. But you see, there's something terribly, terribly wrong with this story, because my friend Dr. Garth Nicholson, a not infrequent guest here at Radio Liberty, a former professor, actually had two or three professorships at MD Anderson Clinic in Houston, was told many weeks ahead of time, before September 11th, that there would be going to be a terrorist attack on September 11th, and of course it was going to involve the Pentagon. And according to Garth, he sent emails to two friends of mine, one Len Horowitz, the other to Joyce Riley, and then he notified people at the highest levels of our government. Now, these FBI agents could come forward, because they would have lost their jobs and might very well have been sent to jail for giving out classified or a secret information, which of course we need to guard our national security. But he was informed, and he got the information out. David Shippers was informed the 1st of August about the attack on Lower Manhattan by FBI agents, and he went to Washington, D.C., and nobody would talk to him. Ashcroft wouldn't talk to him. The leaders of Congress wouldn't talk to him. Nobody wanted to know about the coming terrorist attack, even though our intelligence agencies were on the highest alert. What's wrong with this scenario, John?
Well, what's wrong is obviously somebody knew something, and it was a different agenda afoot.
A different agenda. Maybe this really was a great triumph for the CIA, not an intelligence failure. Are you acquainted with that a quotation from Robert Byrd, when the dust settles from the highest?
This will be shown to be a triumph of intelligence,
right,
rather than a failure.
Not a failure, right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, see, I'm asking the same question right now. We have the, in terms of looking forward, first of all, what you said about survival, remember the whole Y2K affair? We started in 1998, and only in the Christian church did the thing blow up into some kind of a theological controversy where it was so polarized it was impossible to take any kind of a middle ground. You were either slammed on one side or the other. Either there were the naysayers or there were the doomsdayers, that type of thing. Anybody who stood in the middle and said, well, we could have some problems and it's wise to do a little preparation, it was impossible to do that. But now, if you take the same Y2K reasoning, the probability of other terrorist attacks, either porta nukes, dirty nukes, biological warfare, something we haven't thought of, could interrupt the infrastructure. Now it's a real demonstrated threat, Dr. Stan. It's not something theoretical like Y2K was. And the same preparations apply. Because what would happen if the infrastructure in your part, wherever people are listening, goes down? Will you be able to just sort of carry on? I'm not talking about it in an immediate area, but what people don't understand is we are so interlinked now as a culture, and things in different cities, things go through those cities that go to far places in the country. If the infrastructure breaks down, we have to keep on keeping on somehow.
I think we saw that, of course, just this last couple of weeks when they shut down the docks here in California. And suddenly plants were beginning to shut down within a few days, automotive plants. And, had that dock strike continued another couple of weeks, why it would have really decimated the entire economy of our nation.
Right. And my wife Carol was in Fort Collins in college when there was a big strike in Colorado. And within hours, the supermarket shelves were cleared off, except for things like beets and anchovies or things like that, But any food staples were just gone. You walk into a supermarket, you have the illusion of a plenty, and indeed there is plenty, but it's a plenty of flow. It's like electricity or like cash flow. If you turn off the spigot at the other end, the plenty gets used up real quickly at the receiver end. and there's nothing there. And Americans, you know, let's face it, we've had it real good for a long time. So the first thing I would say is let's go back and think Y2K all over again. And I'm not urging panic, obviously. Just get ready. Do what you need to do again. Restock whatever supplies were there. Get the pantry there. Do you have enough water to go? I mean, at least in California, like Karen Lee Bixman would say, people have some earthquake consciousness. I lived there for 20 years, so I know what it's all about. You know that if you're gonna, you may have outages. Up here where I live in the Northwest, let me give you an example. We live out in the country, and power out here is very iffy. Last November, we had a big snowstorm, and power was out for the entire day. And we had to have heating and keep on, so we have a generator. We fired it up, and life went on for 12 hours until the power company could get around to us because lines were down all over the place. And so this is just common sense, but people who have lived in areas where things are reliable, just don't, we don't think in this mode anymore. So I'm just urging people to think about it again.
Well, I think the other thing would be, what is the government planning? What do they know is going to happen? Because they knew that there was going to be a terrorist attack. They were on the highest level of alert. They just didn't tell the American people. They did not tell them that they knew a terrorist attack was coming, and they certainly did not tell the airlines that the terrorist attack was coming. They didn't do the logical things like putting armed people onto the planes, reinforcing the doors, telling the pilots not to let anybody into the cockpit, telling them what to do if they were attacked by terrorists, and how to disorient the terrorists by turning the plane upside down. And there's so many things that could have been done. But the most important thing would have been, of course, to begin checking Middle Easterners getting onto those planes. Some nine of the hijackers were stopped getting onto the plane that morning, and then, they were allowed to get on. And when they knew there was going to be an attack, and they knew that they were going to hijack our planes because the president was told that on the 6th of August, you would think he would have done all of the things. He would have had F-16s in the air constantly until the threat of a terrorist attack and hijacking our planes was over. And instead of that, they did absolutely nothing.
But there are a lot of myths that, you know, one of the things that I've been looking at on the site, I just did an editorial on it, was the number of politically correct myths that we have spawned since the 1960s, which are coming crashing down with the World Trade Center. Now, it doesn't mean people will stop believing in those myths, by the way, but it has destroyed them. One of the arguments is we defend ourselves by disarming ourselves. That's been a myth since the Cold War. By the way, you know all that money we gave to the Russians? Did you see some of the latest intel? Apparently they didn't use it to dismantle their nuclear armament. They used it to upgrade their nuclear arsenal and bring it more current.
Well, you know, we're really not as dumb as we appear to be. We are simply creating the best enemy that money could buy, because behind everything there is another agenda. And I think people have to realize that. And, well, if we have time, maybe in the next hour, we'll go into what I believe that agenda is. But I have no question that the government is planning on a total disruption of this society. And one only has to go to Chris Ruddy's website, newsmax.com, and read about the FEMA plans to build temporary housing for hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of American citizens for relocation camps. What are they planning? They're putting out millions of dollars just for a plan to build these camps, and planning on spending billions of dollars for tent cities in America. Either that is the greatest waste of money of all time, or they know something and they're not telling the American people. Have you gone into that at all, John?
Yeah, we have. Plus, you know, let's go back to the Y2K issue. Do you remember during Y2K, a number of major cities built these giant command centers? Los Angeles was one, New York was another. During which, and they were saying it's to monitor traffic, and indeed they've got cameras at all these critical freeway and traffic intersections. But literally these centers could maintain 200 people for 2 years, you know, there's food, light, air, water, the whole bit. Ironically, New York put its command center in the World Trade Center.
And building number 7, wasn't it, right?
Yeah, so I don't think they counted on that, you know. But the point was, why did we build, you know, some of this stuff just doesn't make any sense unless you're anticipating something far worse than that. That was my question. You know, last couple of days we've had this great revelation, and I'm going to put that in quotes. Oh, my gosh, look at that. The North Koreans have nuclear stuff.
In fact, we've been giving them all this money. We've been building, these plants for them, a nuclear plant, as long as they promised not to develop their nuclear missiles. And suddenly they said, we lied. And then who's been providing the money? And the technology, why, Pakistan. And who's funding Pakistan? We are. We are. There's something wrong with this whole scenario. We give money to Pakistan, and Pakistan gives the technology to the North Koreans who are building missiles to attack us. What's wrong with this scenario?
Right, and to whom have the North Koreans been giving the Nodong missiles? Why the Iranians?
Right.
Oh, look at that. Isn't that interesting? And this whole thing is just totally interlaced, and the only place you don't hear about it, you know, Dr. Stan, this stuff is not hard to find, even in the world's newspapers, if you just go around and gather the articles.
Yeah, but you're not going to hear it about on your local talk show, or Rush Limbaugh is not going to tell you.
That's it, and you're not going to hear it on Peter, Dan, and Tom telling you about it. We're not getting it from, you know, there are some things you get from esoteric sources. Ironically, you can read a lot of this stuff in, say, Jane's Intelligence Digest and commonly available sources. So, I mean, North Korea, we've known, has had weapons of mass destruction. We've known it's been providing smallpox to people like Saddam Hussein. We know it's been providing missile technology to Pakistan and to Iran.
No, wait a minute. You said it had been providing smallpox to Saddam Hussein?
Yeah, that's probably one of the sources from where he got it.
Well, so, do we know that he has smallpox?
Well, as far as I know, we do.
Okay.
But even so, see, here's the deal. Why the timing? You have to remember, we have to ask the timing of the whole thing. Why the timing now for North Korea? We knew this all along, and all of a sudden, kapot. Well, you can pose several different scenarios. Scenario number one is that we knew that if we went to war with Saddam Hussein, this will not be a desert storm, okay? If you begin looking at what some of the experts are saying, this is going to be a more protracted war, a ground war. There won't be as much of it in the air. So we will have to commit troops in there. Now, we know that due to the effeminization and the demilitarization that we've gone through of the military over the last decade or better, most of which happened under the Clinton administration, we are now incapable of fighting a two-theater war. So there were two spots that were likely to cause trouble if we went to war with Saddam Hussein. One was the possibility of North Korea invading South Korea.
And China invading Taiwan, of course.
And China invading Taiwan. Here it is, the Carol got it from me. Dennis Hassert said Saddam had smallpox, Speaker of the House. So I just pulled it up.
Okay, thank you.
So anyway, that's where we got that source.
Well, of course, you know that they're starting to vaccinate all the troops going over there in preparation
right.
for this. So obviously they know something. Now, of course, you go ahead and develop your ideas.
Well, it was interesting. You know, we even talked about smallpox. If you remember, I called you 4 years ago, saying, Dr. Stan, is there any smallpox vaccine still available out there?
And, of course, we can't get it. And
they
prevented the American people from getting this from about 1972 on. If you wanted it, you couldn't get it.
Right.
And, of course, it was because we're here from the government. We want you to know there's no danger, and we don't want you to take it because there's one in a million chance you would die from it.
Right.
And now, of course, they're saying, there is a terrible danger from it. We're from the government. We're here to help you. We want everybody vaccinated. And we've got this wonderful new experimental vaccine with no track record at all. And you're going to be forced to take it, but you have to sign this form saying, you know it's experimental. You know it may not work. There may be all sorts of complications, but you're not going to sue anybody. Just sign right here.
Right. But remember, you and I were talking about it in 1998. I called you
right.
because you and I already knew that biological warfare was coming. And again, we didn't have to go very far. You could find it in Jane's and in Geostrategy and some of the other intelligence services out there. And I was saying, well, I was vaccinated when I was a military brat, so we traveled all over the place and got stuck with more needles than I can think of. But I said, well, can we get it today? Then I called a friend of mine who owns a dairy. And said, hey, do your cows still have cowpox? And he said, no, they give us all this stuff to prevent. I said, darn. So I had thought that, you know, even back then, I thought this was insane that we stopped vaccinating. They said, well, it's been eradicated. No, it's not. The Americans and the Russians still have stocks. And you don't have to be a genius to know what's going to happen to this in the near future.
Yeah, but it's amazing how gullible the American people are. When they told us there was nothing to worry about, everybody said, well, they must be telling the truth. And now they tell us that it is a threat. And, of course, everybody says, well, they must be telling the truth. How can you go from there is no smallpox and now we've got a great threat from smallpox? You can't have the vaccine. Now you must be vaccinated. Is there another agenda? And I will tell you that there are many other agendas, and we know what happened to the military personnel, the young men who went off to fight in Desert Storm to defend our country. They believed in their government, and 200,000 of them have now registered because of their illness from Gulf War illness. Can we trust the vaccines? Well, I'm not willing to recommend vaccines because we know of all the mistakes, all the terrible things that have happened as a result of vaccines. Nobody can figure out why we have so much autism. And now, of course, it's jumped almost 600% in the last 20 years or so. And, of course, so many children, between a million and a half children have autism. And many people believe it's directly related to the vaccination.
And this new vaccine, if you remember when we were kids and growing up and when you were in the early part of your professional career, smallpox vaccine was basically a product, as we said, of cowpox, whereby if you were given a cowpox infection or something related to that, I'm sure they refined it a bit better, you were then immune to smallpox. Now we don't know. This vaccine doesn't have a track record.
And that's the frightening thing. If it were the old cowpox, it'd be one thing, but they don't know anything about this. Are you willing to risk your life and the lives of your family on an unknown vaccine when we know that in other countries they've used it for contraception, when we know that the initial polio vaccine contained a cancer-producing virus, and they knew that and they gave it anyway, and now people are dying from the cancer-producing virus? And then, of course, they changed their monkeys they got it from, and the next group of monkeys had all sorts of other types of monkey herpes viruses that create chronic progressive neurological diseases. At least many people feel that way. The vaccines, they're used throughout the world. In China today, 700 million people have had hepatitis B. Most of them got it from the use of dirty needles during vaccination. Well, hey, we're going to have to take a break here and say goodbye to our listeners up there in the great state of Washington, and remind you that we have a program at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. And please call everybody you know and tell them about the program on the American Christian Network tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And we want to build up a good listening audience there. It's up to you to help us to get the information out. We can't be advertising on television, but you have a telephone and call a dozen of your friends and tell them to start listening. And listen every week, because we're going to give you the information you won't get elsewhere. And pray for America. Pray for revival, because remember, when a nation turns its back on God, God turns his back on that nation. And then please remember to pray for our ministry, for our provision and protection. And till Monday, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And, of course, our special guest this evening is John Leffler of Steel on Steel. And, John, I apologize for forgetting to get your website and your... I got so wound up in what we were talking about, I didn't get out. So let's get out your website and how people can get hold of your information right away.
Well, our website is, you know, it's www.steelonsteel.com.
Okay.
And people can go there. The programs are all archived there for about 12 weeks back, so you can listen to them.
Okay, fine. And John has really one of the best programs in America, all sorts of insightful information, and he's got a wonderful sense of humor. I just love to listen to him. He does a program here on KFER every Wednesday from 7 to 8. So if you don't listen to that program, make it a point to, because he always gets lots of information, and I get some of my better guests from him as well. And so, of course, I'm going to, if you'd like, I will put you in touch with the various families. There are four organizations of families of the survivors of 9-1-1. And, of course, some of them are really not accepting the government's line. They don't want any money. They want the truth about what happened. And the only way they're going to get it is by these lawsuits. And, of course, with the lawsuit, why, they can bring in the FBI agents and force them to testify under oath. And, of course, that's the last thing the government wants. We know that there are lots of FBI agents who knew the attack was coming because they'd told David Shippers, they'd told Garth Nicholson. We know that Willie Brown was told the night before, Mayor Willie Brown of San Francisco, told the night before, 8 hours before the attack, you know, to be very, very cautious flying the next day. We know high officials in the in Defense Department, at least according to Newsweek magazine on the 24th of last year, high government officials canceled their flights for the 11th of September on the 10th of September. What did they know? This wasn't something vague. They had to know something was coming down. But we can't let the American people know that, because they would begin to suspect that this whole thing was staged to get us into World War III. And they would be furious, because an awful lot of boys are going to die in this coming war. And an awful lot of Iraqis are going to die. And an awful lot of civilians are going to die. And, of course, wars are never fought for the reasons that people are told. And as Richard Mayberry said in a recent early warning letter, you know, talking about World War I and World War II, you know, he said, I, after studying these wars, I have a feeling that there is a thing out there, a thing that craves death and destruction. And during the last 2 years of the Second World War, a million people died every month. And time and again, there were opportunities to end the war. And time and again, the American and Allied leaders refused to end it. And the destruction continued because it appeared that the thing was in control. And I think that thing, well, he doesn't want to call it, but I think it's Satan, is in control of what's happening today. And the fact that the church is not talking about this, and the church says, oh, God's in control of everything, he's responsible. I don't believe God wants these things. Sure, he could intervene tomorrow if he wanted to, but I don't think he wants these terrible things to happen. They're happening not because God wants them, but because the church has refused to take a stand for anything of any significance. And the feel-good gospel and the God never does anything bad, and you're going to be raptured out of here before anything bad ever happens. Gospel, and the gospel of Romans 13 has totally neutralized the church. And I think that is not the gospel of Jesus Christ, but the gospel of Satan himself. What are your thoughts, John?
Well, it's interesting you say that. You know, I've had a lot of thoughts while you were talking, because I think you've eloquently sort of placed it there. There is a spiritual dimension, we know that. It's what we were talking about during the break, is let's go a little further and see esoterically, so to speak, where we're going to be. It was sort of ironic. There are haunting premonitions of all of this if you just read different writers. One, of course, H.G. Wells, remember, the New World Order was going to come into would finally be lashed into place after World War III.
Right, and of course that comes from his book, The Shape of Things to Come, published in 1933. Right.
Right, and he said it would be about 1988, so we're a little late, but it would break out somewhere near Basra, Iraq. Now that's haunting. We know that, for example, let's just blow it open. Let's move away from facts and stuff and philosophize for a while. Dmitry Dudeman talked about nuclear attack on the U.S. Joel Skousen, of course, has been warning about that. He's been tracking for a long time. We know the Russians have been upgrading their nuclear arsenal. It doesn't mean they haven't destroyed some of the weapons, but they've been upgrading what they've got. David Wilkerson talked about it. He had a book in 1974 called The Vision. I've got a copy by my bed. It's all marked up. And I remember he started out in this book at one point saying, you know, I don't usually have visions, but I did have this one. And when you read it today, this was written almost 30 years ago. It's like reading today's headlines. And he saw these things very, very clearly. It's just a whole list of things going on. But there's, I would say, a pretty good 25% of the book is yet to be fulfilled, among which are a giant global economic collapse, which we know we're headed to. I mean, we are on that road right now, and it's very near. The second thing will be get a vision of New York all in flames. So, and when this last thing happened in 9-1-1, he said, no, that wasn't it. It's still on its way. You know, he actually confirmed that. So I see three or four prongs out there, all of which, I think Jim Poplava's rogue wave theory is very good. We have rogue wave being, you know, if you, I don't know how many people science is, but if you have sinusoidal wave like in a water type of thing, occasionally the peaks of the waves all come together and just momentarily for a little while form a rogue wave, which is much higher in height than any of the individual waves would have been together, and it's much more powerful. We're looking the world financial market, you know, in Germany, they've been walking around like deer in the headlight in the German banks because of what happened to Commerzbank a week ago when it lost 25% of its value overnight.
That's the third largest bank in Germany, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it's a major bank, and jobs are crumbling. You know, the bankers are wondering if they're going to even have jobs tomorrow, and we're all tied in together. Ironically, a very sober... I read an article in Die Welt by a certified financial planner in Munich who very correctly, just like I believe Jim Poplava has done, has identified the fact that it's been this massive credit bubble that the Federal Reserve created in the United States that has just spread around the world, and it's all got to implode. The housing bubble is huge, way overvalued. The derivatives exposure is staggering. I mean, I wish people, it's really hard to describe these things because they're just numbers on paper, Dr. Stan. You know, so we're teeter-tottering financially. They're just almost on the point of electing a Marxist as the president of Brazil. Da Silva is his last name. And they're going to have a runoff election because the other candidate got something like 25% of the vote. He didn't get a clear margin.
He got about 48%.
About 48%, yeah. Correct. He was within 2% of the majority. But he was threatening to default on Brazil's debts. And what's happening in Latin America now, as their system goes down, in other words, we sneeze, they catch a cold, they're beginning to blame capitalism and the U.S. and IMF, and they're turning back to Marxism again. This is incredible. Socialism at the weakest and Marxism at the best. So we have a whole pot of trouble just starting to brew south of our borders. Vicente Fox, a week or so ago, backed out of the treaty. I grabbed a whole pile of papers before I was coming in here. I can't remember what the name of it was, Treaty of the Americas or something, whereby we all agree that an attack on any one state is an attack on all American states. It's sort of a cohesive hemispheric type policy. Well, Mexico just backed out of it. Why? Well,
maybe he knows something that we don't know.
Something we don't know.
Right.
You know, I mean, let's face it, George Tenet today said, incoming, there's another one on the way, and we can't protect you from it. So, see, there's much bigger stuff brewing. And it isn't all making sense. That's what we can't figure out. It was like this the thing with North Korea. That's another piece in the puzzle today. Why the timing right now? Is it to switch attention from Saddam Hussein? And you know, there's been a toning down of the rhetoric as of yesterday on Saddam Hussein, even though President Bush got what he wanted from the UN Security Council. The toning down, is it because there's no world support for that and maybe it's going to be easier to deal with North Korea? Was it a warning to North Korea? Is it trying to paint them as evil so when we get taken up with Iraq and North Korea does something, the rest of the world won't have a means to balk about? These are all things. You know, the funny part, Dr. Stan, that just always amazes me is the incredible level of naivete of the Americans. And they think this stuff is happening by random chance or something. I said, no, this isn't happening by random chance. These are all strategic moves on a global chessboard. This isn't, you know, there are accidents and fortuitous things, yes. But for the most part, a lot of this is pre-planned.
Oh, I think that it, really all the major things are pre-planned. In fact, in this report, the New World Coming report put out by the Council on Foreign Relations, under the guise of the National Commission for Security in the 21st Century, they basically said that history does not happen. It's created. History does not happen. It's created. And, you know, why have we been financing Russia since its inception back in 1918? The average American doesn't know that, but we have. And why did we finance Adolf Hitler both before and during the war? And why at the end of the Second World War, when the Nazi Gestapo, the most evil organization ever existed, and why did we bring the wicked head of the Gestapo, Heinrich Mueller, to the United States, where he lived out his life comfortably, and so many of the Nazi scientists we brought into this country, and so many other Nazis we helped to go to South America? That doesn't make sense. And of course, the average American has never heard of Operation Paperclip. And why is it that we transferred all that technology to for missiles and for developing sophisticated nuclear weapons to communist China? Do you really think it was because Bill Clinton got $200,000 in campaign contributions? That's the explanation they've given, but if you really believe that, you probably believe your Enron stock's going to come back again. And why is it that, give money to North Korea, and they, of course, provide the missiles to all these other states over there in the Middle East that we may soon be fighting? And, of course, as you commented so well, North Korea has been providing missile technology to Iran and to Syria and to Libya and to Pakistan. And a lot of this technology is our technology. All these things are developed here, most of it. There's something wrong with the scenario. As you pointed out, we're giving money to Russia, and they're using it to upgrade their missiles. We're giving all sorts of money to communist China through the IMF and the World Bank and all of these things which we control, and that we encourage our industries to go over there, and they've invested over almost $500 billion over there, between the United States and Western Europe. I mean, there's something wrong with this whole scenario unless there are other forces out there that the average person doesn't even know exist. And these are, of course, things like the spiritual hierarchy that the people on the other side talk about. And we even have their pamphlet. If you don't believe there's a spiritual hierarchy, read what they say. And they talk about, the spiritual hierarchy. Or Tex Mars has an excellent book. Name will come to me in just a moment. It sort of slipped away from me. He talks about, and he simply quotes from these same people talking about the Illuminated Ones and the Illuminati. They talk about it in this same group, the World Goodwill Association, that puts out the pamphlet on spiritual hierarchy.
Yeah, from Luce's Trust.
Right, of course. And,
yeah.
And they openly brag among themselves. Circle of Intrigue is the name of the book by Tex Mars. And you have to understand that there are forces out there that you're never going to hear about in church and you're never going to learn about in college, and you may catch glimpses of it, if you begin asking why things are happening. But, of course, we have their publications. We subscribe to the things from Lucius Trust. And they're quite open, telling you exactly what they intend. But the average American cannot believe it.
Well, the average American doesn't read it, nor does he or she believe it, because there's an illusion. You know, there's another piece to this puzzle out there. There was an article in the June-July issue of Foreign Affairs, which basically said that we are the world's only real remaining superpower, so we should start acting like it. It was almost a call to coming back to some form of, I guess, what the leftists would call imperialism, which was sort of interesting because we've always viewed the UN as a vehicle into global governance. But what this is seems to be coming back. If we look at the whole issue on Iraq between George Bush and Tony Blair, we have this Anglo-American alliance again emerging, which is hauntingly familiar as the idea that Cecil Rhodes had, you know, for a British-American alliance that would then dominate the whole world in a form of new global governance, I guess is the best way. And they put the UN on notice. So either they're playing good cop, bad cop, which is not unknown in the dialectical process, or there's something else afoot. It could be, you know, the move towards global governance has actually not been a communist socialist type of movement, but rather a very conservative movement, which is willing to use the communists as needed be. In other words, they said there was no, you know, they had no bones whatsoever about playing both sides against the middle. But I began to get the feeling that there's a rift in there. You see, there are other factors now afoot. And whether that rift is a planned rift or a bifurcation, a separation of the ways and putting the UN and some of the other crowd in Europe on notice that we're taking over control now, we're moving in a different direction with or without you.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. There's been a number of articles on the Internet this last week about Dick Cheney and the fact he's sort of laid out a plan many years ago in the early 1990s about America dominating the world. We're the only superpower. We should rule the whole world. That's what it was, American imperialism. And there are at least three or four articles going along with what you're saying. But I have a feeling that as America begins moving towards imperialism, she is drawing closer to the fate of ancient Rome. And, of course, if we have a biological attack here in America, our whole society will fall apart. And I think we're being prepared psychologically to believe that this is going to come from Al-Qaeda or the wicked Saddam Hussein or maybe the wicked Osama bin Laden or maybe the wicked Al-Zawahiri or it doesn't matter. We're always going to, but we know that the anthrax attack came from our own laboratories, our own military laboratories.
You don't believe Hatfield did it, huh?
Right. Well, I don't know who did it. I can say is that this was our strain. This was produced in our laboratories, and somebody had to be vaccinated to be handling those envelopes. So somebody, you know, this was long-range planning. It takes, 6 months to get fully vaccinated. So whatever happened was planned ahead of time, and I will tell you one thing, and that is that Dick Cheney and part of the White House staff went on Cipro. Specifically to prevent anthrax, pulmonary anthrax, on the evening of September 11th of last year. What did they know on September 11th that everybody is just shocked by the horrible spectacle of what we saw that morning? What did they know that evening about the coming anthrax attack that nobody else knew?
Well, that's the question we're always asking, isn't it? I brought the Hatfield thing up because, that doctor, was it Stephen, isn't that his name?
Right.
You know, it's amazing, you said you forgot the title there. You and I go through so much material every week, after a while it all starts to swim, trying to dig through the stuff.
You're about older than you are, John. I can excuse if I can momentarily forget the title of a book. You don't have that excuse.
You mean you can claim a Montaigne moment?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But obviously, I think his life is being wrecked, and true to form, what happens is if they make an inaccurate arrest, rather than saying we goofed, they'll ratchet it up and try to find something to stick him with just to have a charge in order to be able to save face. People don't really understand that's the way it sort of works nowadays. See, when we moved, there's a whole new breed of federal-type person, and also in state and other law enforcement agencies. We had a Judeo-Christian background and belief system for the culture about 40, 50 years ago. Everybody understood that law was sort of there to keep people in line, to handle transgressors, etc. But they could make some reasoned judgments and saying, well, this guy really may have technically broken the law, but that doesn't mean, he didn't intend to and this wasn't it, yada, yada, yada. Now we have a new breed that's come in there. The whole thing, the prison systems in our country are a game. We have the highest per capita people per population in the world. It's just insane. There are probably, I would say, 25% of the people in prison probably shouldn't be behind bars. They're for victimless crimes or things like that. The name of the game, we saw it right here, happen right here in Kootenai County. They wanted to build a new jail. I had a friend of mine who was actually in jail at the time there. Tells you what kind of people I hang out with, right? And he said right when it came time when they were going to vote this whole property tax thing through, they transferred, the sheriff arranged to have prisoners transferred in from the prison system here in state to just pack the jail. Then they bring all the reporters from the local papers over and go, look how overcrowded things are here. We've just got to have a new jail facility. And then as soon as the reporters leave, they ship them back to wherever they came from. This is the way the game is played, Dr. Stan. And it's real hard selling. And to their despicability, the newspapers don't report on it. You know, they're no longer the watchkeepers.
No, the Fourth Estate has become sort of a fifth column in my way of thinking.
It's a fifth column. And as I remember Paul Craig Roberts telling me one time, he said, there's literally a revolving door between the political establishment and the media establishment in Washington, New York. And you can see them changing jobs. I mean, look at George Stephanopoulos, you know.
You mean George Stephanopoulos.
Yes,
I
right.
Know you mean, right. Go ahead. That's a good play on words.
But, I mean, here he goes from the White House to some kind of a commentator for ABC. I can't trust what he's going to say, for Pete's sake. You know, he's in the left. I mean, and look at even some of the pundits and whatever. You have these political people making comments and commentary. And the people who really have something to say, you know.
Like you and me, right.
Yeah, I mean, we're never on the shows. I talked to Dr. Meg Meeker. She has a new book out called Epidemic about the fact that sexually transmitted diseases are now at epidemic proportions among teenagers.
Right.
And she said, you know, she went on O'Reilly and, she said the one thing he did was talk a lot and kept trying to say, well, condoms are better than nothing. And she says, as a doctor, condoms are worse than nothing. It's like roulette, you know, because they're not preventing a lot of STDs. It's questionable even a certain level of pregnancy whether they're preventing it. And we're telling the kids, if it's safe if you use this, go on out and have sex.
There is, one line of Rush Limbaugh's I will always remember, and I congratulate him for it. And he said, you know, there's one thing about condoms. There's one thing about abstinence, it works 100% of the time. Whereas, of course, condoms can't make that claim. Abstinence works 100% of the time in preventing pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases and AIDS.
Right.
And who could argue with, I mean, it's so obvious. And, of course, kids, you know, don't have to, have sex. And they said, well, you know, of course they can't stop themselves, and that's why you have to have a condom, and don't have sex if you don't have a condom. Well, wait a minute, if you don't have a condom and you cannot have sex, why do they have to have condoms to have sex? Why don't they just not have sex? They don't have to. They can hold themselves for marriage. And, you know, I think the other side is just furious because more and more young people are going back to saying, yeah, we're going to save sex for marriage. And the other side saying, no, you can't do that. You don't understand. You got to be promiscuous. You got to have extramarital sex. You know, and they're really pushing this sort of thing. And that is what this is all about. It's trying to break laws, God's law, and, of course, destroy the very soul of these young people.
Well, of course, this was the Marxist tactic as they went into every country. You know, we basically, the Flower Child Revolution of the 60s was a radical leftist movement supported quite often by communists from the Soviet Union because it rejected the norms and the basis that society had stood on. And by the way, I'll say something, Stan. You know, one of the things that people will always ask, well, did you do drugs when you were in college, you know, or something like that? And what they try to say is, here's the logic you get from people who don't want to accept a standard. And that is, if somebody fails to keep the standard but believes in the standard, they'll call him a hypocrite. Now, he's a hypocrite if he claims to believe in it and routinely transgresses it and never gets back on the right path. The difference is they are confusing the failure to keep the standard with the validity of the standard itself.
Right.
According to their realm, because nobody, say, for example, can avoid murdering, we should all just go out and start murdering people. That's the same kind of logic we have. Which, by the way, if you recall, in our public schools, we taught values clarification for a long time. Values clarification did not teach absolutes, but was based on the same dialectical process. And then we're all shocked when a couple of students in Columbine, Colorado, clarify their values and shoot a bunch of their classmates, and then profess horror. And then we have a whole army of psychologists come in to deal with the trauma of all the people who have been traumatized because a couple of kids clarified their values. This is what we've cut ourselves loose on. And the funny thing is whenever it's sort of like anytime somebody comes up and says they don't believe in absolute truth or whatever, ask them for your money that's in their wallet. And you'll see how fast they believe in absolute truth. They don't understand. It's fun to have no absolutes when it applies to them, but when someone else applies those no absolutes to them, they don't like it. And then they begin to impose it. See? This was the whole argument I used about the tolerance movement. A Christian preaches love of all people. There's a difference. Tolerance says, well, we're going to tolerate everybody. Well, what are you going to tolerate? How about pedophiles? Going to tolerate that? Child abusers? Going to tolerate that? What are you going to, and as soon as you don't tolerate one class of people, the whole argument for tolerance collapses. But this is the kind of nonsense we're cut loose on today. And typically, one of the negative aspects of the whole civil rights movement of the 60s, which was essential that we have the civil rights movement, we had to get that ironed out. But one of the attitudes that got hijacked very rapidly toward the latter 60s is anytime someone came up and said, this is a human right, or this is a civil right, everyone else was supposed to uncritically accept it, you know. And frankly, for 30 years, everybody did, I think, because it was the consensus. And if you opened your mouth, you got hooted down. And frankly, there's a whole bunch of people, me included, I think Dr. Alan Keyes, who are just sick and tired of this nonsense. Because what we have done with this whole consensus process, we have lost the ability in our culture to have intelligent debate, to have reason and logic debate based on facts, not on feelings. That's why we're in trouble. And when these times come that you are talking about, and when these crises happen, you now have a group of people who think dialectically on their feeling, thanks to our government education system of the last 30 years, and they will be unable to critically reason their way through in a crisis situation. That's a mob mentality. That's why we're in trouble.
And, you know, of course, one of the things that Samuel Blumenfeld and some of the other people who are experts on reading point out is that if you don't teach children to read phonetically and pronounce words phonetically, their brain doesn't develop normally, and they cannot think critically. And by depriving them of the normal pattern of brain development, you end up with a lot of people who just can't think at all or can't think logically.
Right, because the act of thinking in language is a logical process. Our language is a phonetic-based language. It is not a pictographic type of language.
And that's right brain, left brain.
Right brain, left brain. But because of the discipline of learning to read, we can reason in mathematics, we can reason in logic. And you would be surprised the number of emails I've seen over the years from Christians. I remember I got an email from some man criticizing something I'd said about Bill Clinton. And he rambled and rambled and rambled. And I waited a few days and wrote him a very formal response. And after I'd written it, I waited another day and reread it to make sure. And I sent it off to him. And the first words back from him, I mean, you could see the guy going at the other end. He said, how insulting. Now, there wasn't an insulting word in it, Dr. Stan. The problem was, is this man was operating totally in the realm of feelings. And when confronted with opposing facts, it was an insult to him that someone should even dare challenge what he had said.
Now, of course, he was a right brain functioning individual, and that we're not supposed to be thinking with the right side of our brain. That, as you point out, is the feeling. That has to do with pictures. That has to do with music. But it has absolutely nothing to do with logic.
Well, but that's the culture that we're in, and it's throughout the church is riddled with it now. The other thing, you know, when we grew up, we used to strive for excellence, and I remember there were things I saw a letter that came home to one of my daughter's friends when she was in high school from this other girl's high school science teacher. It was the worst piece of grammatical travesty I've ever seen. And I thought, holy cow. And they go, well, this is science, not grammar. No, no, no. If you come out with an education, you're supposed to be well-rounded. You should be able to express yourself verbally as well as analyze a scientific issue. But no one strives anymore for excellence. I was standing at a bank line one day, and they had these little plaques up by the teller cages, and I pointed out to the teller, I said, that sign is misspelled. She looked at me. Now, in 30 years ago, she would have said, my gosh, you're right. I'll speak to someone. We'll get it fixed. Okay? That was it. Now she said to me, well, oh, my, we mustn't be too picky now, must we? And I said, you know, I really agree with you. See on this deposit slip, move the decimal point one slot to the right. We'll make this a $3,500 deposit instead of $350. She went, oh, I can't do that. I said, well, you don't want to be picky, do you? I mean, I just want to show her how stupid she was. You see what I'm saying? But as I've always said, stupid people don't realize they're stupid.
Well, you know, the tragedy is in school they are actually taught, you know, to have creative spelling. You know, spell it any way you want to. Or even in mathematics, you know, it doesn't matter what two and two is. How do you feel about it?
Right.
And that's the whole idea of the new mathematics. And, you know, when you have a situation like that, you have a society that is not going to be around very much longer, and it may very well that we are seeing the final days of what was once the land of the free, the envy of the world, the home of the brave. We'll be right back in just 3 minutes with Our special guest will invite your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when, of course, we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there in the listening audience, we hope many of you will decide that you want to partner with us in our effort to educate the American people about the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved. Because behind everything going on today is a spiritual battle. And, of course, if you don't understand that, you can't understand anything that's going on. Our churches no longer talk about God is a God of justice or vengeance or judgment. Oh, no, we couldn't do that. That isn't a God that we worship. Our God is just a God of love. And I would point out, if our God is just a God of love, that it is the ultimate triumph of evil. Because if there is no judgment for sin, then why should God have sent his Son to earth to die for our sins? And the whole message of Christianity, of course, is fallacious. And if you read the New Testament, there's far more talk about hell than there is about heaven. But we never talk about hell anymore in our churches. And that's one reason why America's in the trouble it is today, because they've changed the message and the music of our churches. Well, Radio Liberty is having an opportunity to bring the message of truth out across America. If you believe in most of what we're saying, you're probably not going to believe in everything I say, but if you believe that we are on the right track and you'd like to partner with us in our effort to bring the truth to the American people, and now we're on 50 stations across America, 50 outlets every week, and we're picking up a new station up in Seattle, and we'd love to get new stations elsewhere, but we can't frankly do it without your help and your support. So if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to, certainly get a copy of our latest newsletter. And I will tell you, this September newsletter, I think, is one of the finest ones we've done. Why, I think you'll really get real insight into the significance of what happened on September 11th, the importance of the Office of Homeland Security, the USA Patriot Act, MEPA, response of our administration to the September 11th attack, and the information there will help you to discuss what's going on with others. And it's up to you to help us get the word out. We can't do it without you. You have to tell others about our programs. You have to tell them about our website at radioliberty.com. You have to copy our radio programs. You have to copy our newsletters and get them out. That's your job. I can only reach so many people. John Leffler can only reach so many people. But you can reach a lot of people every day. And don't be discouraged if people don't want to hear the truth, because within a few months, things are going to get bad very, very soon. I am firmly convinced of this. As we move into World War III, as we move into a period of chaos and crisis, into a world of shortages, into a world of recurrent terrorist attacks, and then bacteriological attack on America. And I believe, I don't know where it's coming from, but I believe it's coming. And why do I believe it's coming? Well, of course, the government keeps telling us it's coming. The media keeps telling us it's coming. But my good friend Bill Snevelin, who I checked out and I believe he's honest, was told by the chief Satanist in the United States, the man who, when he died, was cited by Masonic magazine. I think it was at that time called The New Age. Maybe it was by that time the Scottish Rite magazine. The Masonic magazine called him the greatest Masonic philosopher of all time. And, of course, he was a Satanist. And he told my friend Bill Snevelin that with the second Gulf War, which he said would occur in the year 2002 or 2003, would come a biological attack on America. So you better start making your preparations and thinking now. And well, there are lots of things you can do, and we'll be talking more about that at our upcoming seminar. Incidentally, we are going to have an all-day seminar. It's going to be out at the Aptos Beach Seascape Golf Course. It's going to be on the 23rd of November. That's the weekend before Thanksgiving. And Bill Snevelin's going to be there. Pardon me, Bill Sardi's going to be there talking about health and what you can do to build up your immune system. And Joan Paris is going to be there. And Jeannie Soderman's going to be there, and Brad Dacus is going to be there. And we're going to talk about preparation for the times that lie ahead, physical health, financial and mostly spiritual. Because if you aren't prepared spiritually for what lies ahead, why, of course, I believe hearts are going to faint and people are going to panic. And you have to know what you believe in and that he is able to keep that which he's committed to us until the final days of our lives. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. We hope that you'll want to come. There'll be a luncheon. There'll be a syllabus. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. We hope to see you there at that all-day seminar on the 23rd of November. It's about 6 weeks from now. Well, Dr. Stan, and of course our special guest this evening is John Leffler, and we're talking, well, we're just sort of talking back and forth, and John is one of the most astute people. He's on the front lines of what's going on. He's in touch with people all across America. He's on the Internet. He's researching. He does a letter for Jim Poplava, who's his talks about the perfect financial storm. Is that, that's his phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, he got it from The Perfect Storm,
right.
But he's written a whole series, I think 5-part series on The Perfect Financial Storm. And I think he even found out today Ted Koppel's logging into his website to read and stuff like that, so it's sort of interesting. But basically, the problems that we're facing and how they're going to interact, remember we talked earlier on the rogue wave concept?
Right.
We've got an imminent economic catastrophe coming. That's not going to be avoidable.
But how can that be when the market's going up?
Well, okay, the market is going up because of the plunge protection team. Jim calls them space shuttle launches because if you watch the graphs in real time on the Dow or the S&P, they'll be floundering. And when they get to what are called resistance or crisis levels, all of a sudden, within about 10 minutes, you'll see something kick in and the line goes straight up like a space shuttle launch. Now, that's an artificial aberration from normal trading. So the stock prices are being manipulated by injection of purchases and sales and purchases as appropriate to deal with the situation. That's the plunge protection team that was put into effect. Remember, continuously in the last 48 months, we've done nothing but go down. All right. I mean, yes, we have these little burbles going up. It's like an airplane that's gliding down. Yeah, you know, you have some little ups and downs. But the peak, this peak is always lower than the previous peak, which is lower than the previous peak. So the general trend line is down. That's what's happening. These are not rallies. These are simply rallies, not recoveries. No bull market goes straight up. No bear market goes straight down. Never has. But we are nowhere near the bottom. The frightening part is, if you remember, OBL, Osama bin Laden, talked about trying to cause economic disruption. Well, you can do that by having the right attacks on the country. But if you just have enough rogue traders around the world and some of the money markets and other areas, you can implode things overnight that way as well. And George Soros, a terrorist George Soros type of person, could easily start to cause that kind of disruption in the money markets. Everybody's so overextended, it's like a giant game of musical chairs right now. If the music stops, some major group or person is going to be without money, and the whole thing begins to implode right there.
And I think that the important thing is there's something like $17 trillion in debt, and even at the most, there's $15 trillion in money. And so imagine there are 17 people playing musical chairs, and there's only 5 chairs. And so when the music stops, everybody scrambles for those 5 chairs.
Right.
And what happens to the other 12 people?
Right, they're left without.
Right.
And typically the left withouts are the average Joe out there. Because remember, the entire world's banking system has been rigged, both by the Jekyll Island bill, the Federal Reserve Act, and by the Bretton Woods Conference, to roll all the responsibility for all, you know, the lender of last resort to the whole world is the American taxpayer. That's pretty much how it works. And so it's this cartel, remember the purpose of a cartel, which is what our Federal Reserve System is an agreement between a private banking system and the federal government, is always put into effect to guard the interests of the cartel, not of the investors or the depositors or anyone else, even though, say, for example, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, we're told is there to protect our deposits. No, it's not. It's to roll the failure of one bank onto the other bank so that the taxpayers, the depositors, can absorb the impact of that. That's what it's there for. It's not there to protect us. So that's prong number one. Prong number two is we're going to have war on terrorism. It will come home. Prong number three, we're stirring up a big hornet's nest over in the Middle East that I don't think the American people really quite understand. And sort of what's interesting, if we look at, you know, everything is multi-layered in reality, Stan. It's like the Matrix. There are different things going on at different levels, and they're all true simultaneously, even though you can't always see them from each level. One of the things that we always knew is that under the new global pantheism, there would be three religions which just could not go along with it, and that is Orthodox Judaism, Orthodox Christianity, and what we would call fundamentalist or true faith Islam. All right, we knew these religions had to go because they do not fit the new global paradigm of a pantheistic, anything goes, syncretistic consensus. So the question was, how are they going to do this? Well, now if you look, the bad boy is right now on the block is Islam. And people are saying that this isn't really Islam. Islam is a religion of peace and all of that we have heard on the media. And that's not really true. The Islam has traditionally divided the world into two halves, the Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Hab. Dar al-Islam is that which has come into submission. That's what the Islam really means, submission to the will of Allah, and that with whom they are at war until the Day of Judgment. That's what it really means. But it's interesting that we've picked the first bad boy on the block because now it's easy to demonize fundamentalist Muslims as radicals and worthy of fighting against. Now, it will be very easy to slide that definition to other religious groups after we go through this round of terrorism and warfare that we're going to see. Anyone who believes the tenets of their own faith too much will be called fundamentalist, radical, extremist. In other words, those are the two things. No one is supposed to believe in anything too much except not believing in things too much. That's sort of the contradiction of the dialectical process. That's what tolerance is all about. That's what diversity is all about. People who preach diversity don't believe in diversity. They're some of the most intolerant people I've ever met, because as soon as they meet someone who doesn't quite agree with their notion of diversity, they're all over them like a bad smell. So this is what we're facing. We're entering a very dark age, and like you say, Dr. Stan, God is able to keep us where we go. My concern is for the little person, and that's why I do what I do. Is I want them to understand what's happening out there so they can make appropriate choices. I can't do it for them. You know, I can't safeguard for them. I can't, in many cases, even give them a recommendation of how to keep themselves safe in certain areas. My hope is that if they understand what's happening, God will provide them the light that they need in their circumstances and their place and location to be able to do what they have to do to just simply keep alive spiritually, physically. That's my concern.
And that is a frightening responsibility that we have for one reason or other. God's given you a voice. He's given me a voice. He's given us the ability to learn the truth. And our job is to try to disseminate that, to get people to prepare for what lies ahead. And I believe that terrible, terrible, terrible times lie ahead. I really do. I think that the America that we knew in the past, we loved in the past, will soon cease to exist.
Well, we've come through, and 9/11 was a watershed event.
Right.
We've been in the process of a paradigm change since about the early 1990s. We came out of the Cold War. The Berlin Wall collapsed. We can argue whether it was intentional or by design, you know, those arguments. The 90s were a coasting period. We were in the Oslo peace process, whereby all of a sudden all of the Arabs on their side of the equation, especially the terrorists, began to behave themselves, because they felt they could get something out of this whole peace process as long as they did. So we coasted through the 90s. The world relationships of who was top dog on the heap really wasn't defined in what this meant, because the Cold War rules were done with. But everybody was proclaiming peace was at hand, and I said, no, this is just a transition period. And sure enough, by the 2000 fall, the peace process collapsed, which we knew it had to. It had to collapse, because up until that point, they had not address the hard issues like the fate of Jerusalem, the final borders, the right of return of refugees, and other minor issues like that. We knew that once those irreconcilable issues went on the table, it would collapse, so it did. And now all of a sudden, within a year of 2000 and the Intifada, 2001 erupts, and we discover that we're not liked by a large clumpet of people overseas, and Americans don't quite understand this. But that was a watershed. Now, we've gone through a paradigm. We've gone through a paradigm of world organization. We've gone through a change in how the global organization is taking place. We've come through a radical change in our philosophical thought in just 20 years. We've moved into this dialectic pantheistic mode of thought, which is radically different than before, except it's the same stuff that was used in communist Russia from the onset. So we know what kind of outcome we can expect. The other thing that people aren't expecting is what is now called fourth-generation warfare. Everybody, you and I, are all legitimate targets and combatants in this warfare. In the new warfare of the 21st century, nations, states, borders, and peoples are not necessarily important. And where people fight will be unimportant. It will not, to a large degree, be armies lining up against each other. Now, that may happen in Iraq, say, for example, but that will not be the wholeheartedness of warfare. All of us are now legitimate targets. And I don't think Americans are psychologically geared to that. You know, even to this day, Dr. Stan, 9-1-1 happened in two isolated places, Lower Manhattan and the Pentagon. We watched it on television. It was sort of horrific. But unless you were there, you really didn't experience the horror. For the most part, it may have touched a lot of people's lives. But frankly, everybody looked at it like a big bad plane crash, and after a while went back to life as usual, at least as far as the economy would let them. I don't think Americans have internalized this. The second thing is, this generation has been brought up as a self-centered generation. We're in trouble, rather than a self-sacrificing generation, which we had in the 30s. In the 30s, you know, everybody understood. What was it? America was built on individuals who took care of themselves and helped their neighbor. Well, but now we have people who believe I, my, and me, everything is here to support me. And the concept of self-sacrifice is not a societal value. You may find individuals with it, but it is not a value across the board. What will this crowd do when it encounters these times, when there's no money, no food, no this? I wish I keep trying to talk myself out of this stuff to see if I'm real. We used to talk 10 years ago as if this were off in the distance. It's no longer in the distance. It's upon us, only we're just starting to see the first rumbles of this earthquake as it hits. And like I said, I keep trying to talk myself out of it, Dr. Stan, but the more I read, you know, I've got a copy right here of the Intelligence Digest from, let's see what date it is here, October 4th, and the whole lead article, The Arab World, An Inside View, and it's showing how the Arab world is viewing our approach to Saddam Hussein. The rest of the Arab world does not view Saddam Hussein as a threat. They view the U.S. as being totally overbearing in this whole thing. And it goes on and on and on. I thought it was a very sober evaluation of what the rest of the Arab world's. The other thing is Saddam Hussein has picked up some friends in the Middle East.